Crosswords for Keith Krober. I don't have much truck with spirits, ghosts, all that. Some people like it and are full of stories of haunted houses and the dead returning. When I was in grade school, there was a little draw out past our end of town that the children dared each other to pass alone at evening and boasted about next day. I seen the Indian! There was supposed to be this ghost of an Indian man, killed there way back when, would come and stand under the trees. An easy thing to see in the twilight if you're looking for it, and they were, so as to boast. I don't understand that triumph people take in telling about seeing ghosts, like they were smarter than others to have seen them, or had outwitted common sense. The Irish beat all for that. A sensible man like Mr. Carey would go ranting on about the second sight when he happened to remember that his grandfather was from Ireland. He'd tell how his mother in Oregon had a premonition of her brother's automobile accident in Ohio, and had shouted out at the dinner table, "Oh, John's in great danger!" And sure enough, he'd run his car into a ditch that very day and was nearly killed. Why he drove into a ditch wasn't part of the story. Maybe he saw a leprechaun, though not likely in Ohio. I am impatient with such stuff. I don't think there are matters that are outside of nature, or that things can happen any way different from the way things do happen. I think that things happen in nature that we don't altogether understand, and to call them ghosts is to make sure we will not understand. The best we can do is not to put a name to them, but to listen. I learned that from Tarina Adams. I met her when I was working as waitress at the highway house of Waffles on the graveyard shift. As I had no family with me at that time, it was easier for me than for the women with children or a husband home, and I was curious to try and see how I liked night work. At first I liked it well enough. The work was easy. Often there'd be a whole hour when nobody came in, and then it would just be a trucker or a couple driving all night, not fussy, not even talkative. Then the day would begin to break, and the pace would liven up, but I was off at 7, just before it got heavy with the breakfast people. It suited me fine to see the sun rise. But I think sleeping in daylight began to trouble me some way. At any rate, all the time I worked nights, I was troubled by thoughts of my mother. Thoughts of her hadn't much bothered me before. I left home at 17 and went to Los Angeles and got married. After my stepfather died, I did visit home in Chico several times so that my babies could see their grandmother and she could see them. She seemed kind of worried and lifeless that couple of years, and I had to try to sort out her taxes and property because she couldn't do it, though she didn't trust my doing it either. She would play with the babies, though, and made a big fuss of Joey especially. Irma was so big and so bald, she wasn't pretty as a baby, and Mama didn't much take to her. Anyhow, then Mama sold the house and married that Pentecostal. He liked me about as much as I liked him, so I didn't come up to Chico again for years. She never tried to come and see the kids. We hardly even talked on the phone. I sent birthday and Christmas cards. I got divorced, and then married Tom, and divorced him, and then the kids' father suddenly wanted custody. He could afford the lawyers, so he got the kids. At that time I was drinking. I had started drinking along with Tom, and I'd had the sense to get loose from him, but not from it. When I was drunk one night, it seems I decided to go and see my mother. When I got sober, I was 200 miles up I-5, so I went on and drove the rest of the way to Chico. It was the middle of the day when I got there. I had to look in the telephone book, not remembering the street, and when I was in the telephone booth, I couldn't think of my mother's married name. I looked up churches in the yellow pages and started looking for Pentecostal ads that might say the preacher's name, and just then I remembered that he was called Bud, Ronald Buddy Bud. So I found the address, not far from where we used to live with my stepfather. She answered the door. First, she stayed behind the screen door. Finally, she opened it. Her hair was gray and looked like she hadn't set or even combed it, and her skin was kind of blotched with big dark spots. It was summer, hot, and she was wearing a sleeveless dress that showed her blotched arms. She weighed at most 90 pounds, I would guess. She had a look of terror in her eyes, so terrible to see that I said, "Mama, what is wrong?" as if I'd seen her yesterday instead of 7 years. And she took hold of me as if she was a drowning woman, and I was a lifeguard. She just said my name and held on to me. Then I heard the preacher, "Who's that? Who's that?" And she clutched harder. She said, "Ailey," in a whisper. "Ailey, he twists me." staring at me the way a scared animal stares. Then she let go and backed away and turned to him and ducked her body and said, "It's my daughter, Ronald." He got between us right away. He was a good enough-looking man, smooth and gray and pink, but he smelled strange. I remembered that as soon as he got near me. He smelled like nail polish, like he'd been preserved. He asked me in, and we sat in the front room and talked some. He talked mostly. He asked about my children. My mother looked as if she didn't know what children. I said their father had them. She said then, "Oh, Ailey, don't let your father have them." I said, "Their father, Mama, not my father." She looked confused, and then she kind of laughed. She got us iced tea. I stayed about an hour, I guess. He talked about some program they had at his church. I went to stay at a motel out on the highway. They hadn't asked where I was staying or was I on the way somewhere. When they didn't ask at first, I decided to say, if they did ask, "I'm on my way to Oregon to a job and just thought I would stop by." But they didn't ask. I stayed at the motel that night, and next day I got back on I-5 and drove up into Oregon. Why not? My car had fuel line trouble in Eugene, and while I was waiting for it to be fixed, I looked at the classifieds. There was a vegetarian restaurant, wanted an experienced waitress. That was me. They were nice kids. After a month, they gave me a week off to go down to L.A. and get my stuff. My second year there, I worked in the kitchen and learned that kind of cooking. They didn't have a license at the restaurant, and I never drank from the time I came to driving the car up I-5 to Chico until I came over here to the coast, 3 years ago now, and began to have a glass of red wine with dinner when I feel like it. Anyhow, 2 years at the Dandelion in Eugene was enough. I came up to Portland and got the job cooking for Mr. Carey at Pecan Pie Catering Company and started getting lawyers lined up to get me some rights to my kids. It turned out all I had to do was ask, since their father's new wife couldn't stand teenagers. I got them back and saw them through high school. It was hard at first. They'd been living higher off the hog with their father, and they had to leave all their friends in L.A., and Joey had been doing a lot of surfing. But as soon as I could get him the skiing stuff, he started going to Mount Hood, and then he was fine. Irma held out. She had learned some ugly ways, and she wasn't going to spare me one of them. Drugs was what I was afraid of, because I feel I don't understand that. But it was liquor she decided to go in for at 13. I was what you could call an expert in that. We worked through it. It took a lot of work, but she got herself straight. But she overdid it. She went and became a born-again, which took her away from me in the other direction. But she was an honor student at her school. It was in those years that my mother died. I was not notified in time for her funeral. When Mr. Carey retired and closed the firm, Irma was working for a year-round Christmas shop over in Cannon Beach, and Joey was in the Coast Guard. I took on the Highway House of Waffles job, mostly because it was so handy to where I lived, south of Portland. I could be there in 2 minutes in my car. So then I went on the late shift, as I said, and after a couple of weeks, Tarina Adams came on that shift too. Tarina was a very quiet person, reserved. She was proud. I thought stuck up at first. When Yance, the night cook, would make the kind of jokes he did, she didn't smile. I always smiled. It was easier to smile. It's like there's a kind of oil that makes their wheels go round, and smiling is part of it, women smiling. They expect it, and when they don't get it, they may not know what's missing, but they tend to seize up and get mean, like a motor you don't oil. Well, Tarina didn't give out any oil. To me, either. She was civil and polite, but a mouth like a straight line. It was like she was deaf. And she looked heavy. I don't mean overweight. She was filled out, but very trim. I mean her look was heavy as if there was a weight in her, weighing down her steps and her head. She kept her eyes down, even. So it seemed like she held herself away, and if that was what she wanted, fine with me. I liked it best those nights when nobody was talking, anyhow. I didn't use my head about Tarina until when I was in the John, which had a thin wall on the kitchen side, and heard Yance say to Bert, "Tar baby ain't here yet." I thought, "Well, you are a fool, Ailey." She wasn't only the only black person working in the restaurant, but the only black person in it ever. In Oregon, The whites and blacks and Chicanos and Indians all tend to keep by themselves, and outside Portland you could think there wasn't anything but whites, and the usual number of them are Yances. So no wonder she wasn't going around oiling anybody's machinery any more than she had to. As soon as there came a time I saw her having a cup of coffee in the back booth of her station, I went over and started asking her did she have family, and so on, pushing at her, pushing at that weight in her, until she began to give a little, like moving a stalled car. But it got going, finally, some. Terina never wanted to talk much, but she liked me all right. It was hard for her to talk. That weight in her, she just carried it around because there was nowhere to put it down. Most of it I never found out about. Her son, who was 20, was living with her, and she said that she could leave him nights now, but when he got worse, she would have to stop working. I was thinking how to ask what was wrong when she asked me not to say anything about her son to anybody there because she was afraid of how they would act, and Mr. Banaski might fire her if he knew. So I guessed I knew enough. "Don't tell that Yance," she said. I said that if I saw Yance's beard was on fire, I wasn't sure I'd notify him. That drew that straight-line mouth out a little bit. In fact, watching Terina, I had begun sparing the oil, saving it for when I wanted to use it. Maybe they all needed it, but not all of them deserved it, I thought. Why waste it on the Yances? But all the time I was getting to know and admire Terina, there was this weight of my own in me, nothing like hers, but still I kept thinking about my mother. It was as if I had something to puzzle out, kind of like a crossword, where you have a word down, say, but you haven't figured out the ones across it. I like crosswords. Often I'd do the one in the paper, those long nights. I did them to keep from thinking, because whatever I started thinking about, it would end up with my mother. If she was the puzzle, then the word down I had was what she said. "Oh, Ailey, don't let your father have them." She didn't mean my real father. He was killed in the South Pacific when I was 3. She meant her second husband, my stepfather Harold. She always called him "your father" to me. Whatever "your father" did was wonderful. If it wasn't wonderful, he hadn't done it. That was the rule. That's where I learned to think like that. But where did she learn it? Why did she learn it? What she said, "don't let him have them," sounded like she knew about the feel-good games. But if she did know, if she had known, why did she let him have me? Maybe she thought then that they were all right. Maybe they were all right. It was only his fingers. When I try to think about it, it always seems like I didn't exactly mind, because if I had, I would have got away somehow, or I would have told her. But I did try to tell her, once. That's why I still don't know what she knew and what she thought, because all she said was the rule. "Your father loves you and would never hurt you." And it was true it didn't hurt. He kept saying, "Doesn't that feel good now? Doesn't that feel good?" kind of crooning, and I didn't know if it did, but I knew it was supposed to. She must have found what I called the shaving cream in my bed, but what did she think about it? I kept thinking about that. What did she think about it? Did she think I'd wet the bed or spilled something? She never asked. What did she think when she washed the sheets? Where did she learn to think what she thought? My stepfather sort of tapered off in my life when I started having my periods and getting my growth. I got tall all in 1 year, between 12 and 13, and I got wise, too, at least for a kid that age, and it was like I began to scare Harold off. He couldn't come at me with his feel-good games when I was nearly his size. I think my big figure did frighten him, because he got prim and prissy. He was always after my mother to make me dress decently, not to wear shorts or halter tops when it was 103 or 104 degrees in Chico. I had turned into a big woman, and he was a little man. He was suited that way to my mother, who wasn't short, but was very fine-boned. As I look back, I think they weren't a bad match, as marriages go. But what about Ronald Buddy Bud? That was a whole other part of the puzzle, and I didn't seem to know any of the definitions. Was she maybe sick that last time I saw her? When she died, they said pneumonia. But maybe she had had a cancer, to pull her down like that into a concentration camp person, a little bent stick. Was that what she was so terrified of? But then why did she say those words I couldn't make sense of at all? He twists me. I kept thinking that it meant something that he was doing to her mind, like they say that people have twisted minds. I was in the John at about 3 in the morning, a long, cold night in November, some ice on the roads, hardly anybody in the restaurant since 11. I had washed my hands and was straightening my uniform blouse, smoothing it down, because it wasn't cut full enough for me. Those words came into my mind again, and I felt them. I knew exactly what they meant. I knew they meant exactly what they said. My hair raised up, and a kind of sick flush ran all over my face and body. I wanted to throw up for a minute. Then it passed, and all I wanted was to get out of that John with its poison smell of sweet cherry disinfectant. I came out. Tarina was just going into the kitchen. I thought she looked startled, but my mind was not on her. A couple of fellows came in from the semi that had just pulled up, and I gave them the red carpet. They were nice men, from the San Joaquin Valley, had been in before on their Seattle run, and I just poured out the oil. I wanted company. I wanted to laugh at some jokes. I wanted to like them. I kept them an hour. When they left, Tarina came over, and we went to the back booth and had a smoke. "Who is the woman, Ailey?" she asked. "What woman?" I asked her. She looked at me, lifting up her eyes under their heavy lids. Tarina was dark-skinned, with eyes a color lighter than her skin. "She's shorter than you, about my height, and her hair's white and kind of tufty-like. She has on a blue and white house dress. She's real thin. Her arms are like sticks, and sort of bruised-looking, like leukemia, you know? I saw her with you once before. Tonight I saw her instead of you, coming out of the ladies' room. I saw her first, and then I looked twice and saw you." "It's my mama," I said. "I thought, maybe," she said. After a minute she asked, "Is she alive?" I shook my head. Tarina didn't ask anything more. I said, "I have been carrying her around lately." "We have that to do," she said, and after a while, "trying to listen." "That's it," I said, "trying to listen to what I didn't hear." Tarina nodded, and that was all we said. That afternoon, when I woke up, I went to the telephone before I was hardly awake yet, like I was obeying orders. I called up the drugstore in Clatsend, where my daughter had started working last summer. The owner put her on the phone, and I said, "Hi, this is your mother," without any idea what else I was going to say. She said, "Hi, Mama. I was thinking about you." The way she said it gave me the next word. I said, "I was thinking I wanted to see you, and maybe move out to some town out there on the coast for a while. I'm fed up here." "There's 3 waitress wanted signs on Main Street," she said. "But you know, Mama, they don't pay shit." I knew then that she had made her own arrangements with Jesus. I was so relieved about that that I said, "Well, I'll be over next week, Wednesday maybe. Can you find me a motel till I get settled?" "I got a couch," she said. I said, "Irma, do you remember my mother at all?" She laughed. "No," she said. "Do I have to?" "No," I said, "but I'll tell you when I get there." But I never did. It didn't seem necessary.